My first few days here, it was really rainy, cold.
Right.
I can't get over it. Like, I could never put shorts on. I feel like, you know, I'm going to be tricked and I'm going to freeze to death if I don't. So I can't take a turtleneck off. That really scares me. Of course, I wear this from, my friends say I wear it, you know, like a uniform. But I think it's metabolism. I just freeze, so. Tell me when you think I should start. I thought I'd wait a couple of minutes. I mean, we're going to have a small group. This is my fate. If you're talking about Salvadoran women, it's not a draw. I found out how I could get 100 people here.
6:45 is a hard time, too. I think I miss more sessions at 6:45.
No, it's a popular time, actually.
Really?
I mean, it isn't on a night like tonight, probably, but
yeah.
A lot of nights, it's, yeah.
As far as our faith, this
is the usual. No, I figured I could do the Enneagrams. Does anybody know what the Enneagrams are? Mm-hmm. I could do that, and I think I could get about 70 people.
Oh, I know what that is. Yeah, I know what that one is. Yeah.
It's fun. It's it's taken very, very serious by a lot of groups, but it's, you know, can be like astrology or a part
That's
of it.
That's the way I think about it. Because people take it so seriously, I was really surprised when I first saw it.
I know. Do you know the Jesuits use it as their formation process?
They use it.
I mean, like, you figure out your number, and that's part of your whole spiritual training, your whole pastoral training, your whole academic training.
I erased the board, or otherwise I'd
be distracted.
Women's weebies, desirable creative.
I just said I know how to get some people here. I'm going to do the
Enneagram. Enneagram, yeah. What number are you?
No,
well, you're pretty perceptive. You could probably guess if you know.
Enneagram.
Oh, you don't?
No, I know some people's numbers by now, but I'm putting it together.
Everybody hates their number. I really hate mine.
Try to. I rejected that immediately.
Well, I know.
She kept promising to lend me her book, and she never did, so I've never done it.
Oh, I'll tell you the Enneagrams. I told Dorothy I'd tell one.
Should we do the staffing tonight?
It would be a good way to sabotage it, wouldn't it? Nothing serious here. All right, I'm going to start. Well, just to begin by saying, and I won't repeat my sort of introduction to this week on Salvadoran women, but the basis of the research that I'm going to be talking about is now I'm going to really be nervous if I do this right, and don't talk too fast. Is this book, which is called "The Hour of the Poor, The Hour of Women," and it's a series of life histories. On the lives of Salvadoran women. And and so that will be the basis of this this presentation. I'm going to start by talking about the base Christian communities and women's relationship to those base Christian communities by telling a story about what is called the Congregation of Mothers in Morazan. And that, in a sense, I think, crystallizes the role that women have had in the base Christian community movement. And after that, I would like to sort of back up and give a very brief history of the base Christian community movement and women's relationship to that. One of the women that I interviewed is a woman named Benancia. Actually, it's not her name. All these names are pseudonyms to protect these women in terms of their role because of security reasons. If their names were publicized when I actually published this book, they would be in danger. In any case, Venancia is a campesina from Morazan, which is one of the most conflicted areas of El Salvador, one of the war zones. It's in a mountainous area near Honduras. And she was a pastoral worker. And she told me the story of the Congregation of Mothers. And I'm going to just read her testimony about these mothers, and I need to tell you ahead of time that what she's referring to when she says all that happened in the early 80s is what happened specifically in 1980 to a village called El Mozote. El Mozote, in a 48-hour period, was bombed to oblivion. 1,000 people were killed in that 48-hour period. There were two survivors. The air offensive that took place in Morazan against the people, and that went really straight throughout the war years, but very intensified in the middle 80s, was, according to Alexander Coburn, writing in The Nation, the worst devastation of the Americas in this century. And yet, few of us even knew what was happening in El Salvador, except that there was a war. Hardly did we know the United States' role in that war, which is to say that we armed that military, we sent in the Huey helicopters, and we sent in C-47s. And the tag for all of us was $1.5 million per day in military assistance. In any case, she refers to Morazan in this testimony, and later, later she talks about the directivas. And just to tell you, the directivas are the representatives of each village or town in each area that the people have organized. And the directivas basically make decisions for the community based on the community's input. Now, some things don't change, and it's true that there are very few directivas where women are on the boards. Occasionally, there really is a transformation beginning in which women are half the directiva. So just those two things. And then she talks about women's role in the process, and the metaphor she uses is very beautiful, very common for women. It has to do with bread. And she talks about women being 11, because what happened after the bombardment of El Mozote, and that was its purpose, the people of Morazan were terrified. And they were afraid to literally come together in any kind of a meeting. The metaphor I'm going to use for that is they stayed behind closed doors with their family in their little casita, their little house. These are the surrounding villages. And they dare not come out. She talks about what was the impetus to open those doors. And it's the mothers forming this congregation. And the congregation formed behind closed doors, but it was there that they began, as is the practice of base Christian communities, to simply reflect upon the gospel in the light of their experience of state terrorism, their experience of knowing that the army was right at the checkpoint San Francisco de Gotera, and their experience of knowing that no foods, no seeds could get past that checkpoint, and that they had hungry kids and sick kids. So here they were confronted with this dilemma, and behind closed doors they began to reflect. So this is her testimony about just that much. When the Congregation of Mothers began, the atmosphere of repression was still very much present. That is, all that had taken place in the 1980s and subsequent years had been committed. So the people would not come together. They were afraid to hold any type of meeting. I feel this is one of the great things women have achieved, is to have raised the people's spirits, to have increased their courage to struggle. Because in all the communities, the men were the ones who were persecuted the most by the armed forces, and therefore it was they who were afraid to get involved in doing anything for the community, because it was too dangerous. So when the women began to struggle to do something for the community, for example, to start a sewing workshop, to begin a small baking collective, to organize a supply of medicines, to start a school, all of this was dangerous. But when the women started doing these things by their action, by means of their actions, they spoke to the men, telling them that united it was possible to overcome oppression. As the women were confronting even the armed forces, I'm going to tell that story next. and demanding their rights, the men also began to discover that they too could do something in their communities. And that is how the community directivas were born, as well as Pari Kosum. Pari Kosum is an umbrella group of all the campesino organizations in Morazan. Just note one characteristic of the base Christian community, highly organically organized. And then she finishes. One of the things I came to admire is that these women and their unity and their willingness to confront the repression have caused the men to stand up too. It was like a yeast that raised the whole community. Well, what she refers to when she speaks of the women confronting even the armed forces is the story of the Congregation of Mothers in Colonel Vargas. Colonel Vargas was the commander at a barracks situated at San Francisco de Gotera, which is the checkpoint you had to pass to cross the Tarola River to go into Morazan. And what was happening is that he was holding up any kind of foods or medicines that were coming from either the Lutheran Church or the diocese, which were the sort of two suppliers of the rural areas. And he would simply confiscate the medicines. And these would be medicines like Pepto-Bismol, which would save a baby's life because they could stop the dehydration, which was just rampant. And as I said yesterday, in El Salvador, when a child reaches the age of 5, this is even before the war, there's a celebration because 2 out of 5 children do not reach the age of 5. They die of malnutrition or worms. And you can just see the kids. They all have these pear-shaped distended bellies, and they're filled with worms, and this is just common. Their hair is not the black, vibrant hair of a Salvadoran who's eaten, you know, decently, but it's stringy, and it's a sort of washed brown color. So this is common, that the mothers would take these little coffins of the children who simply didn't make it. Well, now the situation was even more grave, which is to say they had to have some seed, they had to have medicine. And so what would the mothers do? What would be their what would be their action in these circumstances? Well, I've put this story of the Congregation of Mothers and Colonel Vargas in a sort of a narrative poem, first because it disciplines me and makes the story more efficient, and I get through it. Mm-hmm. So let me just tell that story. The Mothers of Morazan. After the El Masote massacre, they shut frail doors against each other, against memory, or the smallest act of courtesy that might embrace them, might invite voices that would gasp aloud, stupid as lovers, "Somos el pueblo." We are the people. Because then they'd come for the children, for names, and the mothers would save the children, paying with their sex, or naming a campesino they cherished. So they stayed behind doors, saturated with the scent of lemons and mint, under roofs of baked mud, milk white when the moon fell through the pacum trees. In the years of doors, Paco's boy died of measles, Dora Luises from hunger, 14 from diarrhea, 11 from pneumonia. No medicines, no seeds could pass the checkpoint at San Francisco de Gotera, where Colonel Vargas called El Masote a triumph. Vargas's battalion. Each face eerily smeared with black jungle paint. Country boys appointed with boots no peasant could afford. Clips of ammo, M16s, slung on their shoulders. The mothers, their memories, their rage, and the doors of Morazan. Doors they'd open and a sigh of light would brush everything, threatening to remember the time before closed doors, when they were girls and the plaza filled with the music of rancheras, a bullfrog chonchona bass sang to the night. The time when the people's voice grew in their bodies, desiring the world. So the women blessed each other and sent 5 mothers who would pass Vargas checkpoint, walk to the city, persuade the bishop to send 4 truckloads of food. When they returned, Vargas called them whores, ordered the trucks back to the city. In that moment, Matilda's voice, her old voice, returned. Colonel, without this food, our babies will die. And then a miracle, a chorus speaking in one voice. So you may as well kill us all. We won't let the trucks pass. They blocked the road. Vargas said, putas, spit, and waited. The mothers waited for days and days. One dawn, a soldier flagged those trucks towards the mountains, opening doors of sky over muscle foothills, falling rose in the Tarola River, turning the trucks bronze. Advancing in that sepia light was a trail of mothers who desired the eyes of their people, their shyness, this moment to return the looted earth's maize, rice, and seed. This moment with no sorrow, stepping now into the village, filling with applause, filling with the sound of people singing, one voice remembering itself. Every woman's voice breaks the silence. When women speaking from the depths of history speak their word, the word is no. It's a word of resistance. The powerful, deafened by the silence of so many years, presumed the silence was resignation. But this is the prophetic word. It comes from and reveals God in the depths of history. It's the voice of the voiceless ones. It's the poorest of the poor. If Gustavo Gutierrez, the liberation theologian, is correct in assuming that conversion is always conversion to the most radically other in history, then conversion to women is to embrace God's revelation in history to these women, the poorest of the poor. Well, what a revelation it is to discover God, not as the God of the fathers, but God as woman. This broken, violated, raped, disregarded, ignored woman, can this be God's expression? Perhaps if she were articulate, literate even. Perhaps if she had analytic skills. Perhaps if she were expressive, intellectually more advanced. But this is God. What a surprise. This expression of God's presence in history, it turns everything on its head. This is the epiphany. The moment when there is a new revelation. This surprise is an assault, really, to discover that this God is not a Jesuit, not even educated, not ordained, not inevitably a male militant. This God is not an individual, but a people. This pueblo, who are peasants and workers and homeless, who are mostly all there is of God. This obscure God who seeks solidarity, who makes everything new in history, everything possible. This God who announces the audacity of women. What a surprise. My friend Alicia said she knew that there was a new expression of democracy to say nothing of this expression of God's revelation, when she was in Morasan, and this was recently, and they were having a meeting of the base Christian community, and some of the male leadership, and I'll be talking about the clerical leadership even there, were speaking to the group, and she said an old woman got up, and she said, and then I knew that something new had happened, a new gift, because the old woman got up and disagreed with them and said, no, you haven't listened. I mean, this may be common here, that women will speak their word, but 10 years ago, the peasants wouldn't even make eye contact. And a woman? She scolded him. She told him he had not listened well. And then later she said, look, this is our task. And she said, our task is peasants. I mean, imagine this sense of confidence. Our task is that we must continue to be faithful to this gospel so that we can teach the people of other nations how to be faithful. We've done that throughout this war. We must continue. This is sort of an incredible new expression of women's role. Well, what has been sort of briefly the history of the base Christian community in El Salvador? In 1970, a priest named Father Ayalas in Suchitoto began to form base Christian communities. And that's not very mystified, a grouping. I mean, it's going on here, which is basically where the difference being that people come together and read scripture, but now they read it in the light of their experience. And so they read a new scripture, a new gospel. In this case, it was the gospel, as I have suggested, of those from the bottom. And what the peasants discovered in Suchitoto, in a rural area of El Salvador, was probably three things. One, that their suffering, that watching their kids die when there was nothing they could do to feed them very often, or they didn't have proper medicines, or that they made an average of, this is a nation, 5.5 million, and that's true to this day, that the average salary is $200 per year. That it was not God's will that they live that way. It's sort of an enlightenment, confrontation of a feudal system which tied them to the land but gave them no capacity to even feed themselves. Because the oligarchy, at that time 14 families, controlled probably 80% of the land. And so they just discovered that it wasn't God's will because God's, and this was a second discovery, as they looked historically, God's preference was the poor. So that God was on their side. It's not only not a punishment, but it wasn't somehow fate. And so they began to critique their own reality and saw themselves as the beloved of God. And so they began to organize themselves in these base communities. Padre Alice was asked by the archdiocese if he would give a talk on land reform and represent the church. He did that. As he left, all he did was give a talk on land reform. So you should understand how critical the issue of land is in El Salvador. In this very moment in the peace accords, that's precisely what's going to block those peace accords. That the government and the military don't want to yield a thing on land reform, because it means yielding their power. In any case, he left, he walked out into the parking lot, he was picked up, as is very common practice, by security forces, taken to one of the volcanoes outside of San Salvador. He was stripped, beaten, and except that some campesinos had seen him get picked up by security forces and went immediately to the diocese, who immediately called up a couple of officials. He was left for dead, but not killed. The rest of the church that was working with the masses, the majority, the rest of the church made a historic decision. They decided that Padre Alice and the peasants of Suchitoto would not be alone, that they too would begin this method of reading scripture with the eyes of the poor. And so they didn't just say that they were in solidarity with him. Solidarity, as John Sobrino says, is another word for love. They decided that they would act. They opened 15 pastoral centers, and they trained 15,000 pastoral workers in this new method of reading scripture of the base Christian communities. By 1972, probably the most successful of those experiments was in Aguilares with a priest named Rutilio Grande, who was a friend of Romero's. Rutilio Grande worked with the peasants, and after they had been in the base Christian communities and began to understand their dignity and their worth and God's love for them and their love for each other, they said that they, if it wasn't God's will that they suffered, then they had to act to change their situation. If their vision of the beloved humanity was that they wouldn't suffer, they had to struggle to bring that liberation forward. So they organized themselves and formed FECAS, which was a farm workers union. FECAS would later dissolve and it was weak, but at the time, Grande struggled with this question that all of you'd be familiar with. He said that the task of the church, the task of the Iglesia Popular, the popular church, or the church of the poor, he might not have used that term at the time, but the task was to evangelize. It was the people's decision what they would do to change their fate from this fate of suffering. It was the people's decision to decide how they would create the liberation process. And he would, you know, continually discern that he didn't walk into an organizer's role, an organizer of the base, but not of the farm workers union. Well, this distinction was irrelevant to the right. He gave a talk in Apopa in 1977 in which he said, if Jesus Christ came back to El Salvador today, he wouldn't get past Guasapa. He'd be picked up and arrested as a subversive simply because he preached the good news to the poor. The people even said that they saw the orejas or ojos, these are eyes and ears, spies, tape recording his sermon. He was killed 1 month later. He was ambushed by the security forces in a jeep with an old man and a 7-year-old boy. The head of the Salvadoran Episcopate, the highest role you could have of the Episcopate of Bishops in El Salvador, was a new bishop that the people always refer to as Monsignor. It was Romero. Romero, who was a conservative theologian, and that's why he was elected, was asked to come out to Aguilares, where the people said the bells cried for days, rang for days. And he was asked to come out there to the funeral and to view the body and to see what had happened. And John Zabrino, he's a theologian in El Salvador, said that he was there. He went out with him and he said, we were very nervous. We didn't know what to expect. We'd already had theological debates with Romero. He had already accused us Jesuits of being too political. We knew that his theology was extremely orthodox. And so we went with him, knowing, however, that Grande was highly respected by Romero and a friend. And he said, and we went in, and he said it was an incredible moment because you came into this little church and here was a small coffin, the priest and the old man. Such an expression of this church. And he said, we walked in and the place was completely crowded and outside and inside was not a word. And Romero went and saw them. But it was not his fallen friend, it was not Grande that was the source of his conversion, as people say. It was understanding why Grande had died. Because he looked then in the eyes of those peasants, and this was Romero's moment to be interrogated by the poor. They said nothing, they asked nothing. He knew the question in their eyes. Will you side with us? Where will the church stand? He blessed them, he left, and Zabrino said he agreed to come back for a funeral mass, which they had suggested he not come back for, to allow it to stay there in Aguilares and not to come back with the bishop at this mass, because it simply said to the army that the church stood with them. He came back, and Zabrino describes this other moment. He said, the night before, the army had already picked up people. They went into the church. They tore open the tabernacle, they took the ciborium and threw hosts all over. I mean, it was just desecration. But these were hosts. This was a tabernacle. It was the people's lives that would be broken. He came and saw all of this. He came back with this group, and Zabrino was a Jesuit from the UCA, the University of Central America, where the 6 Jesuits would later be killed. Zabrino was out of the country at the time. And he said, after the funeral mass, they prepared a procession to go out into this plaza of Aguilares. And he said, for me, it was really an incredible moment because I still didn't know where this bishop stood. We were happy that he was already willing to go as far as he had, but how far would he go? How much solidarity would there be? They went outside, and he said, I was at the front of the procession with three other priests, and Romero was at the end, and all the campesinos were in between, some standing on the sides. He said, we got into the plaza, and suddenly the army that had been standing on the side stood in the middle and blocked them. They didn't have the rifles trained on them. And he said, we stopped. He said, I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. We had to go to the cemetery. And he said, and then I never will forget it. Romero was coming down the steps and could see ahead what had happened. And he said, we looked back. And then Romero simply said, this is my favorite Spanish word, adelante, forward. And they stepped into history. And so did this priest of the people. Romero's conversion to the side of the people, some people have referred to him as a dupe of the left, because apparently he was a timid man, but highly impressionable. And you know, in male terms in a machismo culture, being impressionable is seen as a weakness. And yet it was an expression of his capacity for relations, which is to say, he was very orthodox, very conservative, but he also had an open heart. He was affected by the people's suffering. Well, to say he was a dupe of the left is absurd. It was the people who were the source of his conversion. Nothing else could explain what he did. In 3 short years, at 57 years old, at the apex of his ecclesiastical career, when he had the most power you could as a cleric receive, he turned his back on his own orthodoxy, reconstructed a whole different theology, and if you listen to his sermons, you just can't believe it. I mean, before and after this experience of the people. And he turned his back on his allies amongst the powerful and all 4 of the bishops in the episcopate. The only one who was at all supportive of him was the Revere Idamas, who is the bishop now, but he was a very careful man, never as prophetic as Romero. Always tried to kind of walk the line. A prudent man, let me put it that way. So Romero, in a sense, was... Romero really was a construction of the people. He was the poor's gift to the world. It's not the other way. And he was whatever it would mean of the sort of new person in history. He was, at a clerical level, another surprise. Because he embraced the poor, and more than that, he authenticated and embraced women as pastors. And this is a story of one of those women. Her name is Anna. And she tells this story about Romero, which for me is just a very small and touching story. Anna has probably trained more pastoral workers in El Salvador than any one single human being. She's very well known and very beloved, but she's a very humble person. She was a Carmelite sister for 25 years. And she and 7 other nuns from her order made a decision in the 70s, as they saw the base Christian communities forming, to go out into the cantons, to go out into the rural areas, and to work with the people and form pastoral teams, base Christian communities. She did that. When the repression came down in the countryside against the campesinos for forming cooperatives, farm cooperatives, the Mother Superior recalled the nuns and said, look, it's too dangerous. You have to come back to the city. You have to come back to the mother house. You can't stay out there. They listened. They went and set up an appointment with Monsignor, and they said, look, here's what's happened. What will we do? Romero said to them, sisters, I can't decide this for you. It has to be your discernment. However, he said, how will we be faithful to the poor? And left them with the question. They made their decision, they went back to the Mother Superior, and they said, we're going back out into the cantons, and had this long discernment process. They went back out there. Several months later, the repression had increased enormously. This time the Mother Superior recalled, this all gets predictable, right, if you know religious orders, and said, you've got two choices. Get back here or leave the Carmelites. And this is a formal order of obedience. They went to Romero again and they said, look, here's our dilemma. And Romero said, sisters, only you can make this decision. But before you do, I would like you to read these documents. He had just come back from Puebla, which was sort of Medellin too, and Puebla simply said, the church should make a preferential option for the poor. So in a way, he told them to decide, but he kind of waited it, you know. Which I don't think it would have taken much. These women had come to understand that their obedience and their vows was to this expression of God in history. It was to the people. They made that decision and went back, told the Mother Superior, and apparently never took off their habits. I mean, I don't know how they kind of left that moment, but they went back out to the cantons. And before they went back out there, they went to Romero and they said, this is a decision we've made. They told him, and he said to them, look, sisters. And of course he was delighted. He said, look, sisters, with this decision you've made, call the people of your base Christian communities together. Decide upon a day to celebrate your faithfulness to them, and I will come and I will witness your vows to the people. And she described this incredible moment when Romero comes out, they have this big celebration, all the base communities come together. And Sister Anna had two catechists, and she referred to them by name to me and told me later that these two young women who were 17 and 16, one of them was beheaded later, and another was shot. But for this celebration, they made her a dress, a red dress that she still kept. If you can imagine this reversal, this historical reversal. Before Romero, he said, I'm only a witness to these vows. They made a vow of obedience to the people, to God discovered amongst the poor. They made a vow of chastity. They made a vow of poverty. And that day, Anna took off a habit of 25 years, and she put on the red dress that the people had made, the habit of the poor, the habit of the people. So it's just a beautiful story and sense of Romero's taking very serious women's ministry. Another woman was also a sister named Matilda, and like Anna, she had been part of a religious order, and she was Romero's secretary. And she had been part of a religious order, and she made the decision to not work in the chancery or diocesan office, but to work with the masses of on the periphery of El Salvador. There are all these shanties, what they call the slum gullies of El Salvador. They're just casitas made of mud and cane stalks. And if you really are doing well, you get corrugated tin to keep the rain off. But it's dirt floors and candles, and it's not even, you know, from here to there, these homes. I'm talking about hundreds and thousands of people in these casitas living along garbage dumps, along the railroad and tracks, along the sewage ravines, where the babies are bathed and it's the water they drink. In any case, she decided to work in one of those areas and worked with a base Christian community. Her base Christian community had 600 people in the last 12 years killed in it. It's a large base Christian community, several groupings. And Matilda made the decision after working in San Salvador, a historic decision with her, what's called the Pequeña Comunidad, the small community. These were religious women that left their order, left their canonical relationship with Rome. This, as far as I'm concerned, is really the good news. But in any case, it was very frightening for them at first because they were no longer, quote, clerics in an official way. I mean, they would take these vows, and I have the vows. They're just incredibly beautiful that were made to the base Christian community by Sister Matilda and by her friend, Sister Sylvia, who was killed in Santa Ana. In any case, they came together, and this group of women, who the people call the chicas, the sort of the young women, the girls, it's an affectionate term. She with Padre Rogelio Poncel, who went to Morazan, where he remained for 12 years of the war. Sylvia went to Santa Ana. And she went into San Vicente. And the group that she was working with, as happens when the bombardments would start, the people would have to go on a guinda. And a guinda is where there's a fast splitting, sometimes of 1,000 people. You just have to take the women and the children and move as quickly as possible to get away from the gunships, get under the saber trees, get some protection. And then you don't move until night. And all movement takes place at night. So you're talking about hundreds of people walking at night. And I can't even begin to tell you, and I don't understand it myself, but I have some sense of it by being told what those marches were like. This is where they would walk up the side of a volcano. There could never be a light. It would tip off the planes. And we sent robotic planes that could go across San Salvador in a very short time with infrared sensors. This is how high tech our involvement was. With infrared sensors that could tell you if a rock moved on the side of a mountain, could radio that information back to the army, and the army could move in and go after whoever was there within seconds. In spite of that kind of technology, in spite of $1.5 million per day, these guys could have put weapons on their ankles. They had so much. They never were able to dislodge the guerrilla opposition, simply because there was just no righteousness on the side of this army. They were just killers, and the people could never support them. In any case, these guindas would be such that you'd have to put your hand on the shoulder of the person who was marching in front of you. Because if you left off a hand, you could be lost in the darkness. There was no light whatsoever. So if everyone ever even thought of what kind of solidarity that would mean, you know, talking about hundreds of people walking up the side of a mountain. And in the rainy season, they would simply squat, put plastic over their heads if they could, and the rains would pour down. And the next morning, they'd go down into the valley, and they would tend to whatever crops they had. They'd do this every night, night after night, months. Matilda went with the people, and she experienced a massacre in San Vicente, and I'll give you the name of the area. And that was the first time it happened, but it happened twice with this community that she was with. The second time it happened, she went with four people, a man and his son, and a third person, I don't remember who it was, and they had heard the army in the area, and they had been walking at night, and they heard the army in the area, and they said, go and investigate, and four of them went on top of a rock. And in the meantime, the army had come around behind the people, and she said the man with her watched them kill his wife and children, and 159 people. And at that moment, she said, and I'm going to quote her a little bit, that for her it was a crisis of her faith. And I'm going to just tell you what she says. The crisis of faith was because I believed in the God of the poor and the oppressed. But I saw it was the poor and the oppressed that always died. Where is God, I asked. The poor are always near the door of death, submerged in poverty and misery. And when they do decide to struggle, they end up killed. The question remained for me, why does God allow the poor to die? And then she talks about this other massacre. And she said, they fired upon them and then threw grenades. People were literally blown to bits. I found pieces of flesh in the trees and the bushes. The children's screams were engraved in my memory. We were not detected, but to stay undetected, the mother with us had to cover the mouth of her baby and almost suffocate the baby. The operation went on for days. We walked through the night in silence, but all I heard were those screams, and all I saw was what had happened. I wondered if I could ever forget what rang in my ears, what played before my eyes. Would I ever be the same again? She goes on, and finally she says, it was more than a crisis of faith. It was a crisis of my own humanity. While experiencing this death and bloodshed, however, I came to know and believe that the suffering was not crushing, but somehow transformative. Somehow I gained strength. The memory of those I've known, the death and the blood, has been transformed, even though I have been indelibly marked by this. And then she goes on to say how she received this hope. She said, "The hope I feel is in the people and in their cause of liberty. Our people have a prophetic faith and courage. Even if they killed all of us, they could never kill the cause of our hope or God's presence among us." And she ends, and this is not metaphoric if you know what she's been through. She says, "Our hope is greater than their death." And I think that that is the great lesson of women's role in this process. To me, it is unimaginable that she could continue this kind of hopefulness. And as I said yesterday, hope is the weapon that the poor have, this insurgent hope, this revolutionary hope. They can't torture it to death in Morazan. They can't blow it into oblivion in Cabañas. Hope, like a phoenix, rises from the ashes. Again and again, it is there. And it is given in the hands and hearts of this people who have remained faithful to each other, kept this solidarity, this act of love and trust. Well, I would like to ask some questions of you in the light of just the sharing of these stories. Because what can happen is we can valorize those women in those circumstances, but really never have to say, how in our lives does this story and this expression of their faithfulness become a historical or spiritual lesson? Really, it's a question of, well, what is our task? So I'm going to just put up a set of questions. I didn't trust the blackboard, so. So this is just a set of questions, and one is, what keeps us behind closed doors? What keeps us from building communities of risk? And I'm asking that in three different ways, but the question is, what keeps us behind closed doors? What's holding us from action? And then how do we transform the fears? Not having named them, I'm going to ask you to do that. And lastly, what must we do? This notion of knowing that our task is to love, but how does that love become efficacious? In other words, how do we act to transform the limit situation? And this is not a throwaway question. I think it's pretty critical. I've seen it come up again and again. I think it's the question of, who are our allies? If we ask this question as North Americans, most of the people in here are North Americans, probably broadly speaking, middle class, although I'm sure there's variations of that. Most people in this room, not all, are white. And the majority are women, not all. So what in this culture, and we are up against a death culture too. It is not state terrorism as it is in Salvador. But it seems to me we are confronted with a silence. With that in mind, how much time do I have? I usually have about 2 minutes when I finally ask this critical question, and then I say 2 minutes. 10 minutes, see, this is good. This is better than usual. Having said that, what's best, and give me some help, some of you who are the process people, in 10 minutes, you could take 5 minutes. This should be done in groups, but I'm afraid if we do it in groups, because, how do you sort of share your deepest fears, with 20 people? On the other hand, if we do it in groups, it's going to maybe not work. What do you think? We should stay in a plenary? But just tell the truth? Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
in a way, I'm jumping down to how do we transform the fears, because I guess, for me, one of the real changing things was going to Central America. And when I look at, and it was experiencing in meeting people who I knew were endangering themselves by their faith and yet were such carriers of joy and peace. And it was really changed. It made me sure that faith could carry me through anything. If they could do this, there had to be a strength there that I had never experienced, and it gave me confidence. So I guess it's almost a question, when you meet modern day martyrs like this, it's a real faith experience. How do we, I think we need community. I think we need community. I think you almost, that's what you need. And I know when we were coming back, we talked a lot about that. Okay, how do you stay faithful? You stay faithful by being in community. And, you know, we talk about being in community with the poor and oppressed here. And I think that's part of it. But I think sometimes we're, you know, the most powerful experience is modern day martyrs, I think, you know. Meeting a person who you know just by what they've chosen to do based on faith is endangering their life, and it is joyful and peace producing. And so, you know, you almost wish that for everyone, you know, that they have that experience to meet people like that.
So one of the things, at least, that you're suggesting is that, and I put this up here, is that the way to do this has something to do with community. You can't
you have
do it alone.
To surround yourself with other people who are struggling with someone.
The other thing is that you've really described being evangelized by faith.
Right.
So that's a big clue. It's not just that we need community, but
in a way, you see, I have a real middle class answer then. Now you have enough money so you can afford to go with Center for Global Education and go to Central America. And, you know, and that's not an option for everybody. And it's not really. So how do we really, I don't know, how do we.
Well, let's go on with this. Some clues anyway.
Yeah.
Well, and see, I don't think you have to go to Central America, because if you listen, and violence against women is common amongst all classes, and if you listen to those stories, and you start, and I'm thinking about transforming the fears, is to start talking about the fears, or talking about the experience is something that's real important to do. And yes, then you do that in community. But, you know, I had an experience where I worked in a small town in rural New Mexico. My job was to begin a teen parenting program, and the stories of those teens were very much like the stories that you've told. These girls have been incested, and that is something that's never talked about in that community. And so that's where it, I think, talking and sharing and being honest in our own neighborhoods is also another area, and that's how we can start the transformation.
So it's in coming in contact with those who are suffering this hidden violence to a great extent, and then telling the truth about it. And so they become evangelizers also. But this is some ingredient too, yes.
This is just in addition to something that Anne said, is that I haven't been able to go to Central America, but I just know that I've been really touched by the power behind someone coming and talking. It was when I was in college, but you know, several people came, one man from El Salvador, well, a man from El Salvador, and later a mother from El Salvador. I say mother because she was talking about her children, but also her husband, and that really was powerful for me. Now also one person who came had been a man who he had been in the army or whatever, the government. He'd been one of the people that had tortured people, and then he, you know, had, through some means, I don't know how, but he had a change of heart, and, you know, then of course his life was in danger, so he left, but he came and talked to us about what he had done, and then And my biggest frustration is feeling like I was so moved by that and tried to learn everything I could then about Central America and took, you know, classes in liberation theology and did all this stuff, but then I still feel like, what can I do? I mean, I know there's a lot, but I don't know exactly what. And so I guess I feel like, oh, I'm not afraid, but that's because here I am in North America. And so in terms of transforming fears and what can we do, I still don't know, but I know that a big start for me was having that contact with someone who was very involved personally in a situation like that. And I guess
so you're saying one of the things is that having heard the word of those who've suffered,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, that was the beginning of a process of your being evangelized.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how do you make the connections between here and the people she's talking about in our midst who are poor and oppressed and suffering, mm-hmm. or whose suffering is hidden,
mm-hmm.
and there, and are there links between those two experiences?
Mm-hmm.
And mostly, what do we do here? So,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a point of when you accept that life is not clean, that people, that it's very natural, that life, that you can't get away from it, and that you accept the responsibility for living and you just say no. And I can listen to all the college lectures, I can watch all the TV that moves me, but there's still a point where I say, no, I'm responsible. And you need the community to help you do that, and you need the support, but I think for every individual, there's a point where it clicks and you just say, no, no, it doesn't have to be this way. And I think that's.
But then what do you do? That's what
then, my question then is. You look at every. I look at the things I consume. I try to figure out if I'm listening or talking. I find somebody that will go with me and say, no, I won't be afraid to walk alone. You know, that's a problem I have because I'm on a college campus. I can't be by myself after 8 o'clock at night to speak out, to teach. I work with children in the summer. I can teach them how not to rape. You know, I can help them with that. And it's just taking that responsibility. But sometimes I'm afraid to speak out, and I think it's because I'm very comfortable. You know, I'm a middle-class person getting a college education. I don't feel I have to say anything.
So one of the things that keeps the middle class silent is comfort, is
yeah.
one of the things you're saying. I know the word that needs to be spoken here is to tell the truth and then to say no to that suffering. But then what keeps people from in a sense, organizing and bringing these communities to some effectiveness, you're saying there's something in our way, you're naming part of it.
Or fear of losing that comfort. You know, that's part of it, is stepping out and giving up material goods or whatever you fear.
That's kind of tough, though. I mean, the question is, how do you do that? You said, well, you have to say no. You have to take personal responsibility. But then after you've done that, I think her question is, how do you know how to prioritize? I mean, I just think of being here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's tough. Is it saving the trees? It isn't so easy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we can do that alone.
No.
I mean, sort of like, I think of Al, how do you get focused? You just get intense or what? I think you need the community.
Yeah.
And then what kind of a community? I'm making it complicated. Go ahead.
No, this isn't going to give an answer, but all I can kind of observe is that the people who come here to Holden are a lot different, and they're not the same people that are out there in the town where I live, okay? I'm probably the only person in a town of 10,000 that has ever been to Holden, and the way people here look at things is entirely different than, I guess, everybody else that I run into. And you made a comment that we watch TV and we see all this stuff that's happening and how many people we're killing and what the government's doing with our money, and there's a point where we say no. But there's millions of Americans that never reach that point and say no.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the people that have to be reached somehow. And I don't know how you reach them, because they just switch off that TV and they're not going to listen to it and they don't get involved. And it's these masses that never really get involved or are off someplace else with the TV and the mass media or their own little world that aren't looking at what we are doing.
So you really want to ask what I think of as a sort of strategic theology question, which is, well, how do you organize people? You know, when they don't want to hear it, and when this is definitely an issue. I want to just say one thing, because otherwise El Salvador can get romantic. This is, I think, critical information. I never knew this. Right now, they're in an incredible moment. And the UCA did a survey, and what they found out is that the entire left in El Salvador, now I'm thinking of left, not in a sectarian way, but, you know, all the popular organizations, all the base Christian communities, all those that have been organizing and struggling against the military is just annihilation. All of that is summarized in El Salvador, probably one of the most highly organized Central or Latin American countries in this century. That's 10% of the people. And the right, including the military, including the government, including the oligarchy, including the very, very small business class, and they have complete state power.